Okay, let's continue. So we're still looking at one qubit with the hope of getting beyond that and having something we could talk about as a processor. But let me put up again the block equations. Because every time we have a qubit, these are going to describe the dynamics And so for a first glimpse of what we need to cover is we need to know something about the energy, something about our control, something about the relaxation times, and about the purity of the system. And it could be, of course, that any of these frequencies would be time dependent. That, you know, any of them might be under your control. And of course, this one we assume at the moment to be time dependent. You could have a system where that also is also always on and you're changing other parameters. But let's save that discussion for modalities to sometime later and just keep going with this. Good. And we looked at the first experiment, which was the Rabi oscillation, which was simply to turn on that field over time, make a measurement here in the eigenbasis, so we're measuring the eigenstates along z. And of course, always, though, we tend to forget to write it down, you have to initialize. And we saw that, of course, by measuring this response, etc., as a function of time, that we would get out the value of this piece, and of course it would be a decay. So I haven't drawn that very well, but there would be a decay. And the decay that we expected was that T Rabi is equal to to the rate of to an equal contribution from T1 and T2 from those two rates. And the other piece we noted is that when we applied a Rabi oscillation, that we're very sensitive to the offset. So if I draw on the block sphere and I put my Rabi field here, And what I want to see is that the spin rotates in the YZ plane at a small variation in delta omega. Tips you out of that. And now you're, of course, are going to process. You're going to nutate in a cone around this effective field. And of course, the effective RF strength that you would see is the square root of the vector sum, just the vector sum of those two frequencies. Okay. An important point to note is that if you have a value, if you have any non-zero value of delta omega, then with a single pulse, you can never reach the minus E axis. So if you want to invert your spins, then you'll never be able to do that precisely if you use just one pulse. You can do it precisely with more than one pulse, of course. Good. Now, we generally end up with a distribution of frequencies over the system. And that's because of some environmental noise often. And remember that what we're reporting here is an expectation value. And so then we're, of course, repeating the measurement many times. And so we're saying that over the repetition of the measurement, these can take a range of values. And it could be because the temperature of the room varies a little bit. It could be because of the magnetic field. Everything tends to influence qubits. It could be because of a charge jumping around on our electrode or a quasi-particle. And now that I described this distribution, it's a challenging concept because there's a time involved. And the piece that we normally are going to try to look at first is to say the time-independent variation. And it's a lousy way to say it, but it's the way it's said in the field. And what it means is that for every instant where you're making a measurement, delta omega has a value. But as you go and you prepare the system to make another measurement, delta omega takes on a random value from that distribution. Okay, so now you have this distribution over measurements. And Ramsey described how to measure this. And as we describe these experiments, I'm going to stop keeping the identity part. Of course, the identity part is the identity part, and regardless of what I do with the system, the identity part is the identity part. So we'll forget the identity part, since we're looking at just sums of unitary dynamics, okay? So I'll just look at the deviation part of the density matrix, the part that doesn't involve. And so the deviation part is going to look like sigma z. There'll be some difference in populations for spin up and spin down, or qubit 0 and qubit 1. And of course, a pi over 2 rotation about this. We'll take sigma x, sigma z into sigma x. And then during this time, we have our internal Hamiltonian, which is delta omega sigma z. And so sigma x will evolve into cosine delta omega tau sigma x plus sine. And quite naturally, this y pulse is going to leave sigma y right where it is. It commutes, and so only this piece will show up. And so at this point, we would have minus cosine delta omega t sigma z. And so this becomes our observable. And it's worthwhile to remember that the Bloch equations tell us that this is multiplied by e to the minus t over t2, the dephasing rate. And so likewise, when I make a measurement, the measurement
should be tau.
Yeah, it should be tau. The measure, the signal as a function of tau is going to be the integral p of delta omega cosine delta omega tau e to the minus tau over t2 integrated over delta omega. And this piece, you'll recognize as the cosine transform. It's worth pointing out that, of course, I didn't really have to put the RF field along the x-axis or the y-axis. In fact, I've already screwed up and put the RF field along the y-axis there and along the x-axis here. But we can put the RF field anywhere we like in the transverse plane. I don't add it to the Bloch equations because then I need to add another phase and it gets to be messy. But that's a control element we have. And so if I wanted to measure the cosine dependence and I wanted to separately measure the sine dependence, then I could do that by changing the phase of that last pulse by 90 degrees. And so then I could take S of tau as being the cosine part plus I the sine part. And so I could have a Fourier integral that you would like a little bit better. Like so. And so if I take this and I take the Fourier transform, then I return this probability distribution. So the Fourier transform of S of tau is equal to P of delta omega. But I need to keep this piece, right? And you'll remember the Wiener-Kitchen theorem, which says that the Fourier transform of a product of functions is equal to the transform of their convolution. Yeah? And so this is convolved with a Lorentzian with a width given by 1 over pi. pi times t2. And so we can recover an estimation of the distribution. Of course, it's a distribution which is broadened slightly by this Lorentzian. But if the distribution is sharp compared to that broadening, then we don't really care that the distribution is there. You know, if the distribution is broad, then I don't really care that the Lorentzian's there. I've made a good estimate anyways. So either way,
Convolution.
Yeah. Yeah, so unfortunately we use the same symbol for too many things. But in signal processing, that's convolution. Good. Now there's a horror in the way we talk about this process. That almost always the width of this distribution is equated with a Lorentzian width. And of course, this piece is Lorentzian, because when we put the noise operators there, we said that the noise was stochastic, so that each element of it was random. But this distribution is due to some environmental pieces. And so it's very unlikely to be Lorentzian. You know, if it's truly random, then it's going to be Gaussian, in which case it's a mistake to describe it by a Lorentzian line width or time constant. And of course, you saw in the neutron case that it could just be some really complicated function, right? There's no particular reason. And we've measured the thing. So it's further a drag to take something you measure and then say, oh, I'll pretend that it looks something like this, which is what that pretend piece tells us. But it is what's done. And so in the literature, you'll see T2 star, which is the observed decay rate at the 1 over E time, which is not extracted by doing a Lorentzian fit. Okay. Okay, so now we've gotten most of the variables, but not all. So we know delta omega. We can measure the probability delta omega. We know omega sub r. We have estimates of T1 and T2. And unfortunately, I have this estimate of T2 star. And so I want to measure T1. And there are a variety of schemes of doing this. There's a variety of schemes of doing all of these things. But the nicest one, don't need that, is to simply invert the spin state. And then leave after that the RF field off and look at the change in the polarization as a function of time. So integrate that. And so, of course, here you go from sigma z to sigma to minus sigma z. And during this time, you would have a growth of sigma z that was 1 minus 2 e to the minus tau over t1. And of course, the equilibrium value is what you started with and what you're decaying to. And so by measuring this return to equilibrium, then you can get an estimate of T1. And of course, anything you would do to go away from equilibrium and measure return to equilibrium would give you a value of T1, as long as you left your RF field off. But this method is quite robust, except recall that I mentioned that we can't give a good pi rotation. So usually we end up fitting that point as well, which is a small detail. Okay. So now then we have a good estimate of T1. This we really know. We can invent some physics that make it hard to tell, but that we really know. This we really know. So by really know, well, let's say that we know it well enough that when we go through David DiVincenzo's requirements that say, do we have a well-characterized qubit? For those aspects, we have a well-characterized qubit. This, we were starting to know, but we'd like to have a better handle on that. And this piece, we probably do know quite well. So we want to measure T2 directly. And remember that what we said was that we had this time-independent distribution. So although it's a distribution that's going to, that delta mega is going to vary from experiment to experiment, or from shot to shot, it's not going to vary within the time scale that we're doing an experiment. And so I mean, we can put a time scale on that. We can say, oh, this should be constant for a time given by T1 or T2, depending upon what the noise source looks like. And so Erwin Hahn suggested an experiment. And, you know, there comes a moment in physics where you find out that people really do believe physics. And he made the very simple observation that the system was coherent. So coherence means that if I compare two things at different instances in time, I should be able to add the phase evolution of those. And so his experiment, in truth, was to use a pi over 2 pulse after a pi over 2 pulse. And maybe we'll describe that sometime. But this is easier. And he knew this experiment. It's just that the electronics at that moment for doing it were more complicated. So let's go through. So we start off with sigma z. During this, we'll put the rotations along y. So this will rotate us into sigma x. Over this time tau 1, sigma x will evolve into cosine of delta omega tau 1 sigma x plus sine delta omega tau 1 sigma y. And of course, this pi pulse will change the sign here. I won't do anything else. And so let's look at this before we write out the rest of the math. So the effect of the pi over 2 pulse was to put us here, and then the spins rotated. And the model that you want to say is, well, it's going to rotate by a different amount depending upon which instantaneous value of delta omega your system has. And then we're going to give a pi over 2 rotation about y, and so that's going to take us rotation about this axis. And so we'll end up over here. Let me just put a dot there. We'll end up over here or over here. And it's better that at this moment we say, well, let's just look in the xy plane, because the rest of it is not going to matter. So we started off and we went this way, we went that way, and then we ended up reflecting and coming here, we ended up reflecting and coming here. And we can write out the math in a second. But during this time, tau 2, the Hamiltonian is the same as this one, right? These times are short enough that we haven't changed anything. So if we were with this value, then the system would evolve back at the same rate it was before. And at the time tau 2 is equal to tau 1, it would return to the y-axis. And the same thing would happen here. And so you would get an echo. And regardless of the variation in delta omega, at the point tau 2 is equal to tau 1, we would see all of the magnetization along, in this case, the y-axis. And it's an easy thing to show that, of course, if I have a tau 2 evolution, then sigma x is going to evolve as cosine delta omega tau 2 plus sine delta omega tau 2. And this will be sigma x and sigma y. And sigma y, of course, is going to evolve as cosine delta omega tau 2 sigma y minus sine delta omega tau 2 sigma x. So multiply them by sines and cosines. Use your double angle formulas, and life is perfect. You'll see that, yes, everything comes back to sigma y. So we get this echo. And what does this echo depend upon? Well, I didn't write it in, but I should have. During this time, you're decaying as e to the minus t1 over tau over t2. tau 1 over T2. And during this time, you continue to decay. E to the minus tau 2 over T2. Right? This decay is due to irreversible loss of information. So although you have this pi pulse, the actual T2 of your sample isn't changed by that pi pulse. Those are from fast microscopic fluctuations. You can't recover those. But you remove all of the time-dependent stuff. And so now, by setting T1 equal to T2, setting tau1 equal to tau2, and varying that time and measuring the intensity, you recover a measure of T2. Okay, so now we really know this. Yeah. So we're pretty good. We've said that we know the distribution. We know our control fields. We know T1. We know T2. We don't yet know this. That's a little bit surprising. You say, well, we've made all these measurements. Why don't I know the population? Remember that we now have a two-level system. We have the qubit 0 and the qubit 1. But our measurement is always going to be of the population difference between those two. And so remember that Boltzmann's equation said, oh, I can relate that population difference, or this term, to the energy difference and the temperature. And so I have some population here and the rest of the population there. But because I'm only ever going to measure the difference between those two, I don't have any calibration standard. And so I'm going to show you, but maybe not today, we'll see if I get to it, that by adding another qubit, we can measure that. And I don't even need a gate. I just need to add another qubit. And then we can directly measure that as well. But I wanted, before I add a qubit, I want to stop for a moment and say, okay, now we've got one qubit. Before we add another one, let's see what the requirements for a quantum computer tells us that we should be doing as we're building our processor. And there's a rich history in saying, what do we need for quantum computation? And it's only half written, that there's still a lot of things we don't know. And remember that a lot of what we have worked on in the theory of saying, what do I need for a quantum computer, says, well, what do I need to prove using classical tools, using the tools I have available to me, that a quantum computer would work? And of course, if you had a quantum computer, you would not have to rely upon those classical tools. So things will change. But the first set of requirements were given by David DiVincenzo. And so they're called the DiVincenzo requirements. But they were pretty much everywhere in the community. David put them down clearly. So this is early 90s. So the first is that you need a scalable system of well-characterized qubits. So we don't know what it means to be scalable. Perhaps we know what it means to be physical. We don't quite know what it means to be well-characterized. And certainly we don't know, we know that it doesn't have to be qubits. It could be qutrits or other things. And it leaves off a piece which is very convenient. You know, it's always tricky to say, do we know, can we prove something? But it helps to have a tensor product structure. We know that if we have a unary structure, you can't do scalable quantum computing. So if I take a Rydberg atom or some other ladder states, I take a harmonic oscillator and say, I just want to take one harmonic oscillator, and over the number states, I want to write my qubits. You won't be able to do quantum computation. What's that? Because you wouldn't be able to address individual levels, and you wouldn't be able to connect qubits that are distant. There's a nice paper by David Meyer. Okay, we need to initialize into a computational state. We need T2 to be much greater than the time it takes to have a gate. So over there, you know, the time it took to have a gate is scales as 1 over omega RF. And so the product of omega RF T2 should be a big number. Need a universal gate set, which simply says you need to be able to go everywhere in your computational Hilbert space. So if I start off in my space in any state, there must be some way of going to any other state within the computational space. Turns out that this is really easy to achieve. You need it to be able to measure the state of a qubit. And you don't need to be able to measure the states of all qubits, but you need to be able to measure the state of a qubit. And these sets of rules are sort of like the minimum bar. If you have a proposal for a new quantum computer, and it doesn't have all of these, you don't have a proposal for a quantum computer. Okay. Now, he later on added 2 others that I'm not going to list here. One that you could convert from a stationary to a flying qubit, and the other that you could transmit a flying qubit with reasonable fidelity. Those are both important, but they're not going to... We're going to capture that same physics a little bit later. Now,
so where would you say the big problem is in satisfying?
Let me put some more requirements, and I'll come back to that. Okay. So, those aren't enough. We need to be able to get to a processor that is robust to small errors. And so many people in the field have contributed to this, but Dan Gottesman is a person who's brought the ideas together. And of course, starting in his PhD work, already described quite concretely the challenges. So the first thing you need is a low error rate. We don't know exactly what that means, but every time you're in the lab and you get a low error rate, you could imagine that there's someone else in the lab who says it needs to be even lower. You must be able to do things in parallel. That almost the only thing you do with your quantum computers is correct errors. And so if you can't correct errors in parallel, you'll never be able to catch up. Part of getting errors out of your system is to make sure that they're really out of your system. And so you need to have a way of removing entropy from your system. And the way of removing entropy is to reset your qubits. And that needs to be on demand. So you need to be able to push a button and some set of your qubits are reset to a fiducial state. Errors must be local. That if you have errors between qubits that are not easily connected by gates. Now the fact that you say we have universal control is really easy, right? I can have some really complicated path to communicate between two qubits and have universal control. But if I have an error between two distant qubits, where I have to go over that complicated path to correct them, they'll never be able to catch up with the errors. And so the errors can't get out of hand. So as your physical system becomes larger and larger, no new things should happen. And that we don't know how to do. It's related to these. We need to keep information in the Hilbert space we're using. So we say that we have qubits. Well, for a lot of the physical systems, the qubit is going to be, we chose two eigenstates out of a complicated manifold of eigenstates. We say, this is our qubit. But then the information is naturally going to be easy to leave in any of the other states or to leak into those. And it's not a problem that information would briefly leak into another state outside of your Hilbert space. But it is a problem if you leave it there. So you need to be able to keep directing information back into the computational space. And we know a little bit about how to do that.
Suppose I had two cubes, like just a single qubit.
Yeah.
But then I had like two other states, which are kind of connected to the first two.
Yeah.
And then it's kind of coming into like stabilizer stuff. If I had my code such that whatever happened between, kind of the two states that I called my qubits, exactly the same operation occurred between the other two, then will I be able to get away with the last?
So you can't get away with anything where you use the word exactly.
Right, okay.
So that's the challenge. And you can find lots of ways of building gates that put things back. But it's incumbent on the designer to look at the precision with which those things have to happen. And so these are if that's the minimum level that we need to have something that we should advertise as a quantum processor, this is the minimum level we need to say, oh, there's a chance that I could reach fault tolerance, that I could remove errors fast enough that their growth never gets away from me. But they're still not everything. So there's, there's desirable, which might be necessary, parts. And the first is gates between distant qubits. And so you can imagine that I have some set of nodes on a lattice. Most quantum computers end up being a two-dimensional array. And then you would say, oh, well, I can connect one node to the next node, to its nearest neighbor. And we would have universality if we kept our errors local. You know, it says, oh, maybe we could have fault tolerance. But there would be great inefficiencies in that system because occasionally we'd need to actually test what's happening over the processor. And so it would help to have one channel that would tie one end of the one distant node to another. And so this is very powerful. We tend to think in terms of precision in gates and a little bit in suppression of errors and initializing. But it's just as important that the measurement be fast, reliable. And if I'm doing quantum error correction, which I better be doing, the measurement needs to be in parallel too. The other piece is that I need to have the errors looking largely like they're independent. So if I have correlated errors, if a bit is rotated over here a little bit and one's rotated over there a little bit with some correlation, that's very hard to control. And if you have a model, maybe you can get some things, but even the crosstalk of your control lines leads to errors that are hard to prevent from propagating. So these things, you make a mistake if you don't include those in your design for your quantum processor. That so now let's spend a couple seconds trying to give a first take at your question, which is the right question to say, well, okay, we've got a bunch of systems. What's difficult about this? The first thing that's difficult is locality of errors. That says, I need the errors only to happen in the neighborhood where I'm going to do a gate. And the gates are probably going to be nearest physical neighbors. We're next nearest. But you know that physics gives you Hamiltonians that don't have a cutoff. So, you know, the dipolar interaction and the Coulombic interaction, okay, extend out. And so then, and they extend out in a way that, you know, the dipolar interaction is conditionally divergent. So if I have a set of spins, and I bring a spin next to it and say, well, let me use this spin as a test spin. Tell me the state of all those spins. Well, the spins that are within 1 to 2 nanometers have the same importance as the spins that are within 1 to 2 kilometers. Okay? And so you get this logarithmic divergence. It depends upon the state, of course. It's conditional. But we don't know how that plays into this process. And it's a bit of a drag if you said, oh, well, I've got this quantum computer, it'll work unless I happen to rely upon these particular states. And then you don't have a quantum computer. So keeping things local is, in my opinion, an important open question. We don't do parallel operations very well. And so that is a real hole in the system. So this piece is a challenge. That piece is a challenge. The next part is I can show you a quantum system that does each of those steps without the first scalable piece. I can show you a system where we can initialize. I can show you a system where T2 is long compared to the gate. I can show you a system. Almost any system has a universal gate set. I can show you systems where you have fast, reliable measurement. Every system has some measurement. But they tend to be in different systems. And so we have this challenge that we can take one system that I can reset easily, one system that I can control easily. And so the tendency in the community is to build hybrid systems where we try to use different architectures for different pieces and to connect those together. And that's just starting, and we'll have another set of rules for how to control those hybrid systems. This piece, gates between distant qubits, that's very difficult too. So we can take a resonator and we can use it, so we can make quantum channels that will connect those qubits. But then those qubits tend to look like local qubits. They don't tend to look like distant qubits. And it's hard in a two-dimensional processor to write an interconnect that jumps over something. And almost all of the processors that we make tend to be local, tend to be two-dimensional. And we try to get around this, particularly in the ion traps, by reshuffling the ions. But then, of course, you can say, oh, I can take a distant qubit and I can make it local. But now you've made it local. You know, it's not that you have this connection to a distant qubit. So this means that we still need to have some new ideas there. And that, of course, also ties into this scalable piece. We don't know what we mean by scalable. And we need an architecture. And there's very little architectural thought that is deep enough in the community. Right? There are thoughts on architecture, but none that bring in enough of this. And of course, it's a miserable thing to do, right? Because you can say, oh, I'll bring in an architecture, I'll propose something. But you don't have a way of testing it. You don't have those tools to show, can you truly make a quantum processor? You do have the tools to say, can I truly write a particular state over the system? And then just the last piece, and I'm missing it here. Every system today has a bit of that. And it's it's not known that that's really going to be a hard problem. In the 90s, having universal control, people, there were lots of papers published on that, was thought to be a hard problem. And then it was shown by a number of groups that almost any gate set is universal. Here, we say, oh, I have an error that if I turn on this RF field for qubit 1, then qubit 37 sees a little bit of that same field. But that leads to a unitary error. And unitary errors, we like to think, are not a problem, because, of course, if I have a unitary error, then I can, if I make it small enough, then I can do things like the quantum Zeno effect to remove it without ever having to worry about that. In other words, because the error, because the deviation away from the correct state is always going to go as a cosine, then if I simply keep projecting into the state it was in, then I end up suppressing that dynamic.
How do you project the state that it's in
without knowing the state it's in? That's a good question. So we'll come back to it. There are ideas of doing that. Costs you more Hilbert space. But for some modest cost of Hilbert space, you can do that too. Okay, so what I want to do is I want to, next class, start taking these ideas, connecting those to those ideas, still without talking about a particular physical system, and to start talking about two-qubit processes so that we can start to understand how we're going to send information through our system. Good. So I'll stop here.